Okay. Flishtim lakhu et Aron Elohim veyaviuhu me'even ha'ezer Ashdoda. We didn't read this part.
We read it superficially
when we did the numbers on in Beit Shemesh, but we didn't read it analytically and study it. Right?
That's correct.
So that is where we are up to. Uflishtim lakhu et Aron Elohim. The plishtim translate carefully. Uplishtim.
Took the Ark of God.
That would be a general translation, a more specific translation. Plishtim lakhu.
Captured.
Had taken. Vaykhu plishtim would be plishtim took, uflishtim lakhu plishtim had taken. That's an old grammatical issue we've had a number of times, namely that the past perfect tense is depicted in Tanakh by two indicators. One is the use of the simple past tense verb rather than the vavayipuch, the reversal verb, reversal vav. And the reverse of subject predicate, the subject of the verb coming before the verb itself, whereas typically in biblical verbs, vayikru, vayidaber, vayomer, the subject always follows the verb. When the subject is vayikru plishtim, vayashkimu ashdodim, if you just look at this parak, once you put yourself into that time frame, all the verbs are in sequence. Ve'yaviyu me'aven ha'ezer, ve'yikhu plishtim, ve'yatzigu oto, ve'yashkimu ashtodim, ve'yashkimu baboker, v'tichbad yad Hashem, everything is v'vayipuch, with the subject after the verb. When that is reversed, simple past tense with the subject first, it's a depiction that the story is returning to something we had started earlier. This event had preceded that which came just before it, which makes sense. We were talking about the battle with the plishtim, and at that moment, in the battle itself, where was the Aron captured? In Pasuk Yud Aleph, back in Perek Dalet, right? V'Aron Elohim Nilkach U'Shnei V'nei Eli Metu Chofni U'Finchas. So the Aron is captured in Perek Dalet.
Right.
But then the story digresses to finish the picture in Shiloh. And so from there to the end of the parak, our focus had shifted to the conversations in Shiloh with Eli, Eshet Pinchas, etc. Now our subject returns back to tracing the story of the Aron. Uflishtim, Makhut Aron. What happened to that Aron? Back in Pasuk Aleph, it was taken by the Plishtim. The Plishtim had taken it down to Eretz Plishtim, down to the area of Ashdod, from the battlefield, from Ebenezer to Ashdod. So it shifts our attention back to a previous story. Not an uncommon structure in Tanakh, finish one story and then move into the next, even if you have to go back in time in order to put us back into the beginning of that story. Have it very frequently in Chumash, and in Navi, most famous case of this kind of story structure is in Bechirat Yosef, where in Parshat Vayeshev, you didn't really think we weren't going to flip within the first 10 minutes of Shir. You're going to have a poor shlema to it. Parshat Vayeshev, Perek Lamed Zayin of Breishit, is the story of Mechirat Yosef. Right? Mm-hmm. Perek Lamed Chet is a complete digression. Vayhi be'et ahi vayered Yehuda me'et achav. Story of Yehuda and Tamar, which is a long story. It takes place over the course of a number of years. Children are born, children are died, people are marrying. I mean, it's not a story that happens in the span of 6 months. But in the meantime, that story is inserted into the middle of the episode of Mechirat Yosef in order to give us a glimpse of what happens to Yehuda in the aftermath of Mechirat Yosef. Perek Lamed Tet throws us back to the story of Yosef. Now our focus reshifts back to Mechirat Yosef, but it has to go back to what's the first pasuk? Lamed Tet pasuk Aleph. The Yosef who had Mitzrayim. Yosef had been brought down to Mitzrayim, past perfect tense. Who had Mitzrayim? In fact, the substance of that pasuk is almost identical to the last pasuk of Lamed Zayin. If you look at the last pasuk of Lamed Zayin, "V'hamidanim machu oto el Mitzrayim lePotifar." Sris Paro, Sar HaTabachim. Yosef gets sold down to Mitzrayim, Potiphar. What's Perek Lamed Tet Pasuk Aleph? Yosef, Urad Mitzrayim, Aviknehu, Potiphar, Sris Paro, Sar HaTabachim, Ish Mitzrayim, Yad Ishmaelim, Asher Horidu, Shama. Gets bought by Potiphar, Sris Paro. The story just picks up where it ended up in Perek Lamed Zayin. The entire episode of Perek Lamed Chet is a parenthetical inserted piece to give us a glimpse of the aftermath and the impact that that had. Now let's go back to the story. That's exactly what you've got here.
I just realized that Potiphar was Sar HaTabachim. Was sort of a precursor to the time.
Well, you have Sar HaMashkim, Sar HaOfim, Sar HaTabachim.
Well, wasn't one of the two people that he...
Sar HaMashkim and Sar HaOfim.
Oh, wrong one. Okay, never mind.
Right, they worked for Sarah Tabachim.
Okay.
That's right.
He was a good guy.
Yeah, the Sarah Tabachim is the he's the chief chef, and the Sarah Ofim and Sarah Mashkim are the what do they call the
sous chef
and the
line
workers. That's right. All right, Parakei Uflishtim Lakut Avon Aleim VaYaviu MeEvan HaEzer Ashdoda. They go from the battlefield of Evan HaEzer, which I showed you. It's just around the area of Tel Aviv, and a little bit north, actually, of Tel Aviv, around the area of Afek, and take the ark straight south along the coast down to Ashdod. Pasuk Bet. Vayikhu plishtim et aron ha'elohim, vayaviyu oto bet Dagon, vayatzigu oto etzel Dagon. What did the plishtim do with this ark? They stuck it in the temple of Dagon. They put it next to Dagon. They stuck it in this, right next to their big statue of their giant god, Dagon. Dagon is an interesting deity. Comes from the word Dag. It's a whole discussion as to what it looks like. Rashi says it's a idol that's shaped like a fish. Complicated fish that has hands and feet, because we're going to see momentarily that it has a head and hands and feet, so it clearly looks more like a person than a fish. So some suggest it has a picture of a structure that was similar to a human being, but it had a tail. Others say mermaid. It was some kind of a
merman. Is that the masculine
some sort of
merman. Of a mermaid?
But in all cases, it comes from the notion of Dag, which, even if it doesn't look like a fish, which is debatable, it certainly was a deity of the sea. Much as in Greek mythology, you had gods that were over the domain of different different components of life. And
I forgot the name of the Greek god of the sea.
We've got to see is Poseidon.
Yeah, Poseidon.
And then Neptune is Roman
Neptune,
right.
Yeah.
And so because you had seafaring culture, sea conquerors, that's what the Plishtim were, not surprising that their deity would be either shaped like a dog or responsible for the sea and therefore called Dagon.
And this was the same temple that Shimshon collapsed?
Same temple? No. But same temple? No. We're a generation later, but the Plishtim are all related to Dagon. Right? They're all serving Dagon. Shimshon's case was in Azaf, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
Right?
But it was that kind of temple.
Well, but they had temples with Dagon.
They had
and
that type
locations.
Of temple, yes. The same structure, I would assume, same kind of religious
No, it's just the bitter pill.
I'm just saying the bitter pill that, you know, we have Shimshon.
Right. You know, trying to destroy, you know, Shimshon, and here we are back with the police.
Well, we talked about that a little bit, that in a sense, the Shimshon's failure, or the people's failure at the time of, the, of Shimshon, was ultimately what led to the continued subjugation until Chana comes along and says, okay, let's, you know, let Shmuel clean up the mess.
Yeah.
That's very much the story, the cultural context of the Plishtim from Shimshon to here is, we see it as what, five prakim and about a year apart in terms of our study, but it's one period of time. So
it's not that far apart.
No, it's a generation, maybe. How long does it take for Shimshon to grow up? We're not talking about that many years. No, whatever. It's the same era, certainly same era. They took him. The story of Shimshon is in Azza. Vayochazuhu plishtim v'yinakua tenav v'yaridu oto azata. And there it says, "V'sanei plishtim ne'asu lizbach zevach gadol ledagon Elohim ulesimcha."
There you go.
That was the temple in Azza, but it was the same God. We'll see that they're all the Arei Plishtim. They're all five major cities of the Plishtim, each one governed by some kind of leader. They're called the Sarnei Plishtim, and they. So in the same way, in a certain sense, that they took Shimshon and put him on display in their temple to demonstrate the victory of their god Dagon over their enemy, in a certain sense, that's precisely what they've done here. They've taken the ark and put it on display in their temple of Dagon in order to say, let the vanquished serve the victor. Right? Our god was victorious over their god. Which, if you think about it, is a remarkable Chilul Hashem. And if you think about it in Tanakh terms, Moshe's whole argument to God after Chet Egel was not to destroy Bnei Yisrael for the sin of the idolatry, for the sin of Chet Egel, precisely because Ma Yomu Mitzrayim. What will Mitzrayim say? They'll say, right, it was our God who was victorious over them. Here you have the Aron captured clearly for the sins, because of the behavior and the sins and the depravity of Israel, but from the Plishtim's perspective, what are they going to say? When the ark walked into the battlefield, what was the battle cry of the Plishtim? Woe unto us, these are Elohei Israel, these are the gods of Israel that have smitten Egypt and Mitzrayim. Remember that phrase? These are the gods that smote Egypt. Now they're victorious because they were stronger, because they were, so they were stronger, and now they take the ark and they stick it into the temple of Dagon. The Chilul Hashem in that story is remarkable. And so I think to an extent the response is as much to negate the Chilul Hashem in the eyes of the Plishtim as it is to protect the Aron and to restore the Aron to Israel. And there's two agendas here. One is to punish the Plishtim, but the other is to punish the gods of the Plishtim, because that's also part of what is at stake in the story in Tanakh. You have to deal with the deity. You have to deal with the idolatry of it. Closest analogy would be Yitziat Mitzrayim, Makot Mitzrayim. What happened in Makot Mitzrayim? It wasn't enough to smite the Egyptians or to punish Paro or to punish the people. V'chol Elohei Mitzrayim Eseh Shvatim. You had to deal with the deities of Egypt. That's why the plagues of Egypt were directed in part against the symbols of Egyptian deities. The sun, the Nile, Paro, right? These are deities in Egyptian culture, and that's exactly what they had to
cattle.
Right? Cattle is more Hindu than Egyptian, but certainly, but the sun was certainly a deity of a god of Egypt. The sun and the water, right? The sun and the Nile, the sources of life. והשכימו אשדודים ממחרת, והנה דגון נופל לפניו ארצה, לפני ארון השם. They get up in the morning, what did they find? They came to morning religious morning services,
yeah.
And they found that Dagon is lying on the floor.
He's hung over.
Right? Literally.
Like Abraham and the...
Very reminiscent of the story of Abraham. We're going to come to that in a second. So, you're, it's a remarkable story. This is a statue that stands tall, strong, and now it's... And the Aaron was put at its feet, so to speak, and now... Nofel, Fanav, Aronash, it's lying on the floor as if
the Dagon's on the floor.
As if the Dagon is bowing to the Aron. So what do the Ashtadim do? Oh, they realize suddenly, oh, this God of Israel, these gods of this God of the Aron, this is more powerful than our God? Not quite. Tshuva they didn't yet do. They stood Dagon up. He said, Dagon, what are you doing on the floor? You don't belong on the floor. Let's stand up. Day one. Day two. Vayashkimu baboker mimocharat. Hine Dagon nefel lefanav arza lifnei Aron Hashem. For the second time, Dagon is lying on the floor.
This time.
Only this time, v'rosh Dagon u'shtei kapot yadav krutot el hamiftan. Rak Dagon nishar alav. This time, the head and the two hands, two palms, kapot yadav, were severed. Only the torso, the dag part of Dagon, remained intact. It's this time it was broken. You want to demonstrate the falsity of an idol? What do? You break it. Especially when you have the Aron sitting in the inside this temple of Dagon, and the Aron is quite capable of taking care of itself. Al ken lo yidrachu kohanei Dagon v'chol ha'baim beit Dagon miftan Dagon be'ashdod ad yom hazeh. The irony is, what did the Plishtim do? They said suddenly, oh, you know what, this God of Israel represented by this Aron, this is too powerful for even our God Dagon, now we can't hide it. So the first day they could hide it, they could just stand Dagon up, and nobody would know the difference. At the time they opened the doors for morning prayers, nobody would be any wiser. The second time they couldn't hide it anymore because Dagon is broken. Right? Decapitated hands. Right? So once they couldn't hide it anymore, so now they needed another excuse. What was the excuse? That the Aron was more powerful than their Dagon, they weren't yet prepared to say. So what was their excuse? Alkein lo yidrachu kohanei Dagon v'chol ha'baim beit Dagon al miftan Dagon ba'ashdod. From that point forward, they would never step on the threshold of the temple. Meaning?
Closed it up.
No, they came in. They just wouldn't step on the threshold, which is where the Aron was, which is where Dagon was broken. Krutot al miftan. That the hands and the feet were sort of broken over the threshold of the... So what do they do? What was their answer?
The threshold.
So yeah, in other words, you couldn't step on it. Meaning? An absolute stubborn refusal to acknowledge that this Aron could have any real power. So how could they excuse, or how could they understand the fact that Dagon had fallen and had broken?
Really quick.
Or that there's some significance to
people coming close to the Aron, to Dagon?
Maybe. Or the threshold, the place. Mm. In other words, you have to put yourself into the mindset of the pagan world, which is a hard thing for us to do because we don't live there.
Why would they think the Aron would follow?
That's a good question, right? That would be the logical choice. But to do that, they'd have to admit
something's wrong.
Right, they have to admit that they were wrong. That they're not prepared
something's
to do. But that they're certainly prepared to admit that there's something in the palace which is significant, and therefore the threshold where Dagon had broken, maybe the threshold, maybe the place, maybe the particular location is of significance, like the rock in the Dome of the Rock, or the right, maybe it's the place. So therefore we're not going to step on that place, because now that place is holy. Everything to avoid the possibility of
the
that the ark is somehow related to this. And so you have this next little paragraph.
It's more like the Twilight Zone, you know?
Okay, I'm not quite sure how to respond to that. Vatichbad Yad Hashem.
It's supernatural.
Yeah, okay. So that we go. Say the same thing about Makot Mitzrayim.
I do.
Okay. Vatichbad Yad Hashem El HaAshdodim Vayishimim. Yad Hashem, God's hand against the Ashdodim. What is Vishimim? Shmama, to destroy them, to make them desolate. Once it's not now, you've dealt with Elohei Dagon, right? You dealt with the gods of the Plishtim. Now, part two, which is now we deal with the Plishtim. Actually, before we read the next part of the story, briefly as an aside, Alan mentioned before the Medrash, the parallel, or the seeming parallel to the Medrash about Abraham. And so we talked about this a number of times. It's another example of parallels between Midrashic stories and biblical events that seemingly are unrelated to each other. And Abraham's story of the furnace is being thrown into the furnace of Nimrod starts with a little episode with the idols. When we teach these midrashim in sort of a preschool environment, we separate them. We don't actually connect them. But actually, the Medrash itself is one story. I'll give you the text of the Medrash. You'll see it. This is the source page for today. I'll come back to sources 1 through 3 in a moment, but source number 4 is the actual Medrash in Bereshit Rabbah. And I've suggested before that this Medrash is actually a compilation of various stories in Tanakh that all somehow relate to the milieu and the world of Avraham and what Chazal, sort of a glimpse back into the world of a series of shiurim I gave on Midrashic methodology. Midrash would all, as a methodology, would often do this: take biblical stories and move them, shift them around, superimpose them onto other events or other biblical personalities in order to connect stories. So, this one in particular is based on a pasuk that Haran died al pnei Terach Aviv, while Terach was still alive, and the Midrash goes through this whole description about what was it that brought about Haran's death. That Medrash linking us is the source for the story of Avraham. Rabbi Chiya bar Berei de Rav Adad de Yafo said the following: Terach avad tzlamim haya. Terach was an idol worshipper. By the way, how do we know in the text of Tanakh that Terach was an idol worshipper? How do we know from Tanakh? That's the Medrash. How do I know in Tanakh that he was an idol worshipper? There's only one place in Tanakh, in all of Tanakh, where Terach's idolatrous origins are mentioned, and it's not in Sefer Bereishit. This is the mystery of it all. Chazal put it all together because they had the world of Tanakh in the back of the hand by heart, and then they had. No, it's not in Divayamim. And not only is it not in Divayamim, but you all know the pasuk because you say it every year.
Mm-hmm. Oh, right here. On
Pesach. Yes.
Where?
Where Terach is mentioned. And that is in Yehoshua Perek Chaf Dalet.
We didn't do Chaf Dalet though, did we?
Sure, Yehoshua? We did. Absolutely. Absolutely. Can't think Yehoshua, not too Perek Chaf Dalet. But it was a while ago. So
before Shelton.
Yeshua's last speech to the people of Israel in Shechem. Yeshua Perek Chavdalad V'yasof Yeshua at Kol Shiftei Yisrael Shechema gathered everybody together in Shechem. Ma'ikra l'ziknei Yisrael l'roshav l'shaftav l'shotrav v'yitzvu lifnei Elohim, gathered them all together to by the Mishkan. Pasuk Bet V'yomar Yeshua Kol Ha'am Ka'amar Hashem Elokei Yisrael. This pasuk we quote in the Haggadah. Be'ever ha'nahar Yeshua avotechem me'olam. Your origins of your ancestors were Abraham on the other side of the Nahar. Terach avi Avraham, v'avi Nachor. V'yavdu Elohim acherim. V'akach et avichem et Avraham me'ever ha'nahar, v'olech oto b'chol eretz Kanaan, v'arbe etzero, v'eten lo et Yitzchak, v'eten lo Yitzchak et Yaakov et Esav, v'eten lo Esav et Haseir, l'veshet oto, v'yaakov uvanav yardu Mitzrayim. The origins of how we come down to Mitzrayim are recorded here for the first time, starting from Terach. Terach, father of Abraham, worshipped other idols. I took Abraham from Abraham, I brought him into the land of Canaan. I gave him children. I gave him Yitzchak. I gave Yitzchak, Yaakov, and Esav. Esav went to Har Seir. Yaakov went down to Mitzrayim. All geschäft. It's remarkable that it starts from Terach. There's a reason for it in the context of Sefer Yeshua. That's the pasuk we quote on the Haggadah. And that's the only other reference we have, and the only explicit reference in Tanakh that Terach was an idol worshiper. So again, part of this, less part of learning Midrash, we're learning Tanakh, but part of understanding Midrash is to recognize that Chazal had Tanakh by heart in the back of their hands. And so they assumed much of the information that we don't have and have to search for, because they assumed it. One of the reasons why when we turn...
They connected everything.
That's right. They connected everything, and when we turn Midrashim into arbitrary stories, in a certain sense, we do a disservice to the purpose for which these Midrashim were composed. Well, they were composed to draw our attention to all of these various disparate pieces. So here's Terach, Oved Elohim Acherim, clearly... Abraham, who's clearly not, how that transition takes place in Tanakh, in Chumash, in Breshit, is nowhere to be recorded. Parshat Lech Lecha starts with Lech Lecha. The truth is that the only single episode in Tanakh that we have that separates Abraham from the milieu and culture of his generation is the Tower of Babel, at which time Abraham was 48 years old. So that seems to be episodically the transformative moment in Abraham's life. And then comes along the Medrash and says, well, here's a broader picture. Let's go back. Let's recreate a broader canvas from an earlier time. So the Medrash says the following. Chad zman nafik le'atat. One time he had to go out. Hoshiv Avraham mocher tachtav. So he put Avraham in his place as the
salesperson
at that particular day. Havi'ati bar inish, a certain person came in, by the yazban, he wanted to buy a idol. Hava amar lei, so Avraham said to him, tell me, by kamashnin at, how old are you? Hava amar lei, by chamishin, hashitin, he would say, I'm 50 or I'm 60. Woe unto that person, 60 years old, who wants to worship and bow down to something we created today.
He's a heck of a salesman.
He's a good salesman, right?
He'd be fired.
He was fired. He was fired by being thrown into the furnace of Nimrod. So the guy would go out and he'd be embarrassed and he would leave. Chad zman ata chad itata. Another occasion, a certain woman came in, she had a plate full of flour. She said to him, I'd like you to offer this flour to one of the idols. So at that point, Abraham saw he had a great opportunity. Come, nasiv bekul sabiyadei. So he took a big stick. V'tavrehon lekulan psile. And he broke all of the idols. V'yayv buklusa biyada derava, the Havi Benon, then he took the stick and he put it into the hands of the biggest of all the idols that were there. And when his father came back, what did he see? He saw all the idols smashed except one. Came into Atavu, Amarlai, man avidlun kadin, what happened here? Amarlai, so Avram said, man chaper minach, how, I can't hide this from you. What am I going to do? I have to tell you the truth. The truth is, atachad itta, a certain woman came in, te'ina lachada pinach de solat, she was carrying a plate of flour. She asked me to offer it to one of the idols. So I gave it to one of them. And ana echo kadmai. To which point this idol said, I eat first. Ana echo kadmai. And the other idol said, no, I eat first. So in the end, so the biggest of them all took a stick and he smashed them all so that he could have the flour. Which his father looked at him and he said, "Amar lei ma atam maflebi. What do you think I am, an idiot? You mock me. What are you mocking me for?" V'yed inun, they know, they have knowledge, they have interaction, they're alive. What kind of a business is that? So Amar lei, Abraham said, "Ule yishmu haznecha ma shepicha omer. Would your ears hear what your mouth is saying?" So at that point, what did Nimrod do? What did Terach do? Right? It's a good argument, right? He's got him just where he wants him. There's something about the pagan mentality which is so stubborn. I mean, I don't think it's just pagan. I think it's all of us. It's the refusal to let go of our frame of reference when it comes to our belief system, even if the truth is staring us in the face. So Terach, instead of acknowledging his mistake, Nazbe umasre leNimrod, took Avraham and he handed him over to Nimrod, who was the king. Now, again, this whole medrash is completely is a complete convergence of all these anachronistic images and ideas. Nimrod's reference here is only because, and this story supposedly takes place in Ur Kasdim, because that's, the Medrash says that's how he ran away from Ur Kasdim, right? Nimrod is the king of Babel. He goes from Ur Kasdim to Babel. I mean, this is completely anachronistic. But Nimrod is the king of Babel, Shinar, where Migdal Babel took place. So this whole, it's all interconnected to these stories in Sefer Bereishit. Comes to Nimrod, Amar Lei, Nizgud Lenura. Then the whole conversation shifts. Nimrod and Abraham now have an intellectual conversation. We bow down to fire. So Abraham says, Nizgud Lamaya, the Matin Lenua, so why don't you bow down to water that extinguishes fire? So Amalei Nimrod, Nizgud Lamaya. So Nimrod said, fine, so bow down to water. Imke Nizgud La'anana, the Toin Maya, so let's bow to the clouds. Do they carry the water? Nizkud la anana, she said, fine, let's bow to the clouds. Amarle, nizkud la ruchadim, vaden anana, let's play to the wind that can scatter the winds, the clouds. Amarle, nizkud la rucha, fine, let's bow to the wind. Amarle, nizkud la barinish, desavil rucha, let's bow to a human being, because a human being can stand in the place of wind. It can withstand the wind. Most winds, not all. Amarle, at that point, Nimrod got the picture and he said, Milin ata mishtai, and mishtai, you are playing words with me, playing games. I'm not interested in word games. Ani eni mishtach ve ela leor. I bow down to fire. I worship fire. Hare ani mashlichab tocho. I'm going to throw you into fire. V'yavo Eloh shata mishtach ve ela v'yatzilcha hemenu. And let your God come and save you. Habitaman Haran Ka'im Palug, right? There's Haran. That's how this whole story got started. So Haran is standing there. Haman, they asked him, Nu Haman, where are you? Haran, what's your position? Amar Manashach, Im Nitzeach Avraham, Ana Amar, Minda Avraham, Ana. Im Nitzeach Nimrod, Ana Amar, the Nimrod, Ana. If Avraham is victorious, I'll say I belong to Avraham. If he's not, I'll say I belong to Nimrod. I'll hedge my bets. I'll wait. I'll see what happens. Kevin Shirad Avraham Lekivshin Esh Vinitzol. It's interesting. It never tells us the story of Avraham. It just tells us, Agav, since once Avraham went into the fire and was saved, at that point, they turned to Haran and they said, okay, Haran, your turn. What did Haran say? Amalon min Avramana. I belong to the God of Avraham. They threw him into the fire, but his faith wasn't quite as strong as Avraham's. And he was consumed. And he was destroyed. Now, this Medrash is a collection of at least three different stories in Tanakh. You have the son breaking the idols of his father, which is the story of Gidon and the idols of and the altar of Baal. You have the fiery furnace, which is completely anachronistic. That's borrowed from the story of Daniel and Kivshan Ha'esh. Oh, actually, not even Daniel. It's Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah in the fiery furnace of Nebuchadnezzar, Melech Bavel. Mm-hmm. And there's an element in here that I think is also taken from our story. Namely, that in order, it's a combination of our story and Gidon. Namely, that in order to demonstrate the falsity of an idol, what do you have to do?
Break it.
And the one who breaks an idol is perceived as stronger in the eyes of the people. And that's precisely how the story begins, where Avraham takes the idols, breaks them all, comes to Nimrod. Nimrod says, let's worship fire. And Avraham starts an intellectual game with him about who's the strongest God. Why worship a mediocre God? Worship the stronger one. Well, which one's the stronger one? And go from there to that. The one who can break the others, the one who can smash the others, whether it be physically or whether it be intellectually. But the notion is somehow you're going to go from one level to the next and stronger and stronger and stronger. You're looking for the strongest source or force in the world, and that's who you're going to serve. So finally, Avraham realizes that ultimately the strongest force in human civilization is the one that you can't see. That's the lesson he learned from Migdal Bavel. The whole human enterprise and united under one campaign to build a giant tower comes along God and says, poof, and they're gone. That's what Avraham took away from Migdal Bavel. And the Medrash depicts that, both physically, the idols fighting each other, and intellectually, in his banter with Nebuchadnezzar.
Nimrod,
Nebuchadnezzar, it all interchanges. Right? But that's exactly what's happening in the palace of Ashdod, in the temple of Dagon, where they placed the Aron in there as a kind of symbol of victory. Maybe they even wanted Dagon to do their job for them, since they couldn't break the Aron. Maybe they wanted Dagon to break it for them. And the result was that Dagon fell on the ground broken. And now they're faced with a reality that they need to address. So in typical style, instead of acknowledging the truth that stood before them, what did they do?
Move
the Aron out and send it on its way.
Export the problem.
Right.
Share it with your neighbors.
Right. They're very brotherly. Share and share alike. Pasuk Vav. V'tichbad yad Hashem al ha'ashdodim v'yishimim b'yachotam b'tchorim et Ashdod v'et gvula. Ashdod, not only the temple and the gods, but also the people of Ashdod, smitten with these tchorim. We had a whole discussion about what these tchorim were. Did we discuss that in the Mefarshim? On the source page, you have a couple of the Mefarshim. They talk about the various kinds of ailments that these tchorim could possibly be related to. In all cases, it was some kind of intestinal calamity. Later, we'll see the role of achbarim, mashchitim et ha'aretz, who were running the rats that were overrunning the land. There is one suggestion that's actually interesting, that the tchorim, not translated as we translate tchorim in modern Hebrew, which is how they translate it there, the swellings or some sort of intestinal or anal swellings, but rather based on the pasuk. Take a look in Perek Vav Pasuk He. Va'asitem tzalmei tchoreichem v'tzalmei achbereichem hamashchitim et ha'aretz.
Where are we going?
To show you what the tchorim are, I just jumped to Perek Vav Pasuk He. We are in Perek He, but I just jumped ahead one pasuk. Va'asitem tzalmei tchoreichem v'tzalmei achbereichem hamashchitim et ha'aretz. When they sent back the ark, they sent it back with a whole bunch of idols, a whole bunch of little statues, golden statues. What were they made out of? What were they made of? What were they made to look like? They made tzlamim, forms of
achbar,
tchorim and achbarim. So typically, it's understood to be a sort of the golden statues of the source of their ailment and the symptom of their ailment. Right, the achbarim. Achbar is a kind of rat, a mouse or a rat. In Tanakh, it's the same. But it's also possible that there were different types of animals that brought these disease, and that the tchorim were a kind of mashchitim, they were a kind of animal, not the way we translate it in modern Hebrew, but in the Tanakh context, it's a rare word, that it would parallel the achbarim. And so that there were some kind of
dever.
That Arov and Dever, which are very common, right? How did Makot Mitzrayim come about? Well, the two plagues that are juxtaposed to each other are Arov and Dever. Arov means wild beasts, and the wild beasts, when it was all done, they died. What happens when you have an overrun of animals that die in the populated area?
Bugs.
You get bugs and you get disease. So not surprising that from Arov you go to Dever. Typically Dever kills people. Talk about that next week. We'll talk about Makot Mitzrayim. Dever, uniquely so in the context of Yitzhak Mitzrayim, did not kill human beings, but typically Arov goes together with Dever, and Dever is devastating. So that's exactly what you have here. Achbarim and Tchorim overrunning the land, Mashchitim et Ha'aretz, and people are dying. Mashchitim et Ha'aretz. That is precisely the story here. V'tichbad yad Hashem al ashtodim v'shimem v'yachotam batchorim et ashtod v'et gvulah. Pasuk zayin, v'yiru anshei ashtod kichein. People of Ashtod saw that that was the case. V'yomru, lo yeshev aron alohi Yisrael imanu. This Aaron can't stay here.
It's gotta go.
Ki kashto yado aleinu v'al dagon aloheinu. It's hand is against us and our god Dagon. Remember the dual nature of this attack against the gods and against them. So vayishlachu vayesfu et kol sanei plishtim alehem. They gathered together all of the heads of the plishtim and they said, "Ma na'aseh la'aron ala Yisrael? What are we going to do with this ark?" Vayomru, "Gat yisov aron ala Yisrael. Send it to Gat." They sent it to God. What happens when it got to God? Sorry for the pun. What happened when it arrived in God? Same thing. Yad Hashem. All smitten, old, young. Again, this Ketivan Kri, they were smitten with. It's all throughout the entire story. It's written afelim. It's a ketiv and kri. Most mefarshim say it's a function of kavod to the text, that lashon naki. We use a somewhat cleaner language.
But is there a real meaning to afelim? I mean, is it used anywhere else?
I'd have to look it up. Swellings of some kind, or that means ultimately. Some kind of intestinal.
Mm.
Rashi describes it as these animals or these that would come in achbarim that would nichnisim bim nikvehem vishomtim bnei me'ayim v'yotzim.
Gross.
Right.
It's not a new one or
so. Exactly. So, you know, there's a reason why it's depicted in a euphemistic language. Vayishachu et aron Elohim Ekron. So they sent the Aaron to
Ekron.
Ekron. Vayi kivo Aaron elim Ekron. By the third time that Aaron comes to Ekron, Vayi zakua Ekronim lemor. They cried out and they said, Hisabu elayet Aaron ala Yisrael la miteinu ve'atame. You send the Aaron ala Yisrael to me to kill me and my people. So at this point, they're all like, they sent it from Ashdod to Gat, from Gat to Ekron. It's like
a hot potato.
That's exactly what it is. It's a hot potato. Vayishlechu v'yasvu et kol sanei plishtim. Vayamru, they said, the sanei plishtim, shalchu et Aaron alei Yisrael. Send this Aaron away. V'yashov lim komo. Let it go back home. V'lo yamit oti v'etami. It should not smite me and my people. People were dying in the city. This isn't just a discomfort. People were dying. And not only that, we thought the people who were dying were the people who were smitten by tchorim. There's two different things. The tchorim was a symptom of discomfort. The people who were dying, and those who didn't die, were smitten with tchorim.
They felt like dying.
Shavat The cry of the city went up to the heavens. Vatal shavat ha'ir hashamayim. All of this, by the way, described to us and happening in the course of, what, a week or two or three or four, however long it takes place, says the next pasuk, Vayhi Aaron Hashem b'stei plishtim shiva chodashim. This story took place over the course of
seven months.
This is a process. So now they don't know what to do. Now they're going to call over the priests and the magicians. And they said, what do we do to the Zara? To the Aaron Hashem? How do we send it back? So I'm going to stop you for a moment. We read the story of the test that they designed to send it back, and they sent it on its way. There's a couple of observations I want to point out in this parak. The first is that there's a very interesting transformation going on in the mindset of the plishtim. They don't even know that this transformation is taking place, but they can't escape it. Much like in Mitzrayim, as the plagues began to grow, the sentiment amongst the people began to change long before it changed in the mindset of Paro and his advisors.
Right. Yeah, it took them long enough to call the Kohanim and the magicians.
Yeah, it took them 7 months till they finally got the Kohanim and the Kosmim together and said, okay, now, and even then they didn't just send it back. They had to devise a test and make sure that it really wanted to go back, you know, that kind of thing. That's number one. Number two, you see this transformation in the text. It's subtle, but you see it in the text. Their whole attitude to this Aaron shifts, first in small degrees, and then in major degrees. We go back to the very beginning. The first handful of psukim. How are the... when the plishtim are handling the Aaron, not before Dagon falls, when the plishtim handle the Aaron, look at the way this parak depicts the Aaron and its phraseology. Uflishtim lakhu et
Aaron
Elohim. What is the, in the mindset of the plishtim, what does Aaron Elohim mean?
The God
has conquered
Egypt, or?
What is Aaron Elohim?
It's the honor of the God of the Israelites.
That's not what it says. We'll get to that in a moment. That's
Elohim
not what the word
the
says.
Powers.
Elohim are powers. It's a plural. Like we can turn into a singular if you're talking about Hashem Elohim, but essentially it's a plural. Mm. And it has no further description, meaning... Aaron Elohim means a box of God, the ark of
the powers.
The powers are gods. Right? So they took this ark of gods. Why is it an ark of gods? Right? They don't understand anything about this ark. talked about that once before. They don't understand its sense of the Brit, our own Brit Hashem. The Brit is not in the vocabulary. They have no concept of what the Brit represents, the covenant. They have no concept of the Luchot Eidut. The Torah calls it the Aron HaEidut because it's the testimony. The Torah is very careful whenever it refers to the Ark never to refer to it as Aron HaElokim. It's always either the Aron Brit Hashem or the Aron HaEidut because it represents something. Because we look at the substance of what's inside of this Ark. So the Plishtim, what are they looking at? The Kruvim. We're looking at these two Kruvim sitting on top of it, and therefore it's Aron HaElohim. Twice. Plishtim lakru et Aron HaElohim. Pasuk bet vayikru plishtim et Aron HaElohim. Veyatzigu oto etzel Dagon. They take the ark and they put it into the palace of Dagon. Next to Dagon. Right? And look what happens. In the morning, they wake up and they find Dagon falling on the ground in the front of
Aron Hashem.
Aron Hashem.
It's not Elohim anymore.
Right? Because that's already telling us from our perspective. From our perspective, Dagon has fallen before whom? Right? Before Aron Hashem. This is, that's a whole different concept. They take Dagon, they stand it back up. Next day, they come back in. Vinei Dagon nofel. Arza lifnei pasuk dalet arza lifnei Aron Hashem, again same story, falling on the ground before Aron Hashem. So the plishtim took Aron Elohim and stuck it into the temple. Dagon has fallen before Aron Hashem. Now, you'd hope they get the message, but not quite. So, pasuk vav starts the plague. Vatechvad yad Hashem el ashdodim. Which at the end of this parak is going to be described as Ta'al Shavat al Ir el Hashemayim Kavda Ma'od Yad Elohim Sham. This is the hand of God against us, or the hand of. But now what happens to the Aron? Now listen to the phraseology. Vayu anshei Ashdod Kichen Vyomru. It's a subtle shift that's taken place. When the Ashdodim want to get rid of the Aron, how do they describe it? Lo yeshev Aron Elohei Yisrael. Unlike how they described it before, the Aron was always Aron ha Elohim. There was never an association between these gods and Israel. It was whose God is more powerful. There's an objectivity here. Dagon against the Kruvim. It's Dagon against Elohim Elohim. Even in Perek Dalet, when they described these Kruvim, they said, Oilanu miyatzilenu miyada Elohim ha'adirim ha'elah. Elohim ha'elohim ha'makim et Mitzrayim. Absolute refusal to acknowledge that these gods, in the sense of the Kruvim, belong to, or have an allegiance or an affinity to, these Ivrim. Bunch of Hebrew slaves. Now, after the fall of Dagon, and the beginning of the Tchorim, suddenly, what was described as Aron HaElohim is now Aron
HaElohim.
And now, as we read through the rest of the Pesukim, pay attention to the reference to the Aron in every Pasuk. Starting in Pasuk Zayin. I'm just going to read without translating. You'll see the phraseology. Vayir'u anshei Ashdod kichein v'yomru lo yeshev Aron Elohi Yisrael imanu. Ki kashta yado aleinu v'al Dagon Eloheinu. Overpowered us and our God Dagon. Vayishlechu. ויספו את כל שני פלישתים עליהם, ויאמרו, מה נעשה לארון אלוהי ישראל? ויאמרו, גת יסוב ארון אלוהי ישראל. ויסבו את ארון אלוהי ישראל. ויהי אחרי היסבו אותו, ותהי יד השם בעיר מאומה גדולה מאוד, ויחד אנשי העיר מקטון ויד גדול, ויסתרו להם תחורים, so the people of God also, you'll forgive me, got it. Vayishalchu et Aron Elohim Ekron. So they got rid of the Aron. This Aron Elohim comes to Ekron. Vayi kevo Aron Elohim Ekron vayizaku Ekronim lemoi sabu elai et. They call out. What do they call out? Because Aron Elohim Yisrael lahamiteinu ve'etami. Vayishalchu ve'yesvu et kol shanei plishtim emu shalchu et Aron Elohim Yisrael. And then they really get to it in Parak Vav Pasuk Vav. Understand the transition that's taking place. This is a remarkable transformation. If the purpose of the plagues, if the purpose of this Aaron fighting against the Plishtim was to remove from their mindset the Chilul Hashem, that their God was victorious over the gods of Israel or over the God per se, if it was a pure pagan victory. So what did Hashem do? He set up this Aaron in such a way that suddenly they're forced to acknowledge, at least l'shitatam, at least from their perspective, not only the power of this deity, but its allegiance to
Israel.
And see, a shift from Aron Elohim to Aron Elohim Yisrael. I didn't count how many times, but at least 7 or 8 times. Every time the Plishtim speak, it's now Aron Elohim Yisrael. For the one time they talk to the Kohanim and the Kosmim, it's already Aron Hashem. That's the story. There's two other significant elements in this story. One, and maybe we'll address them both next week, but one is the sudden reference at the end of the story to Kosmim. These magicians, soothsayers, diviners, in terms of devising a test, a plot, to figure out. The stubbornness of these Plishtim is remarkable. They're stubborn enough to they can't figure out what happened in the temple of Dagon. From city to city, they keep pushing this Aron after they keep being smitten one after the other. And when they finally, 7 months later, decide this is really Aron Elohim Yisrael, it's got to go back to Israel, they don't just send it back to Israel gift wrapped. They have to call over the Kosmim and the Kohanim to figure out how to devise a test. The stubbornness is remarkable. Part of that stubbornness is the mentality of the Kosem. And it's a really good window into the whole pagan world. What was Samim all about? What was the whole notion of this soothsaying, diviner, ritual concept? The most famous of the soothsayers, most famous of these magicians, was Bilam. His famous was Bilam. How do we know he was a Kosem? Right? He's described in the Tanakh almost like a Navi, but in Chumash almost like a Navi. But you know that his status was much more analogous to that of a Kosem. How do we know?
Because he spoke to the donkey.
Well.
Because he kept trying to figure out a way to.
The simplest way to know something is because the Tanakh tells us so. And when they finally kill Bilam, when do they finally kill Bilam?
I didn't know they killed him.
Yeah, they finally kill him. Who and finally kills
time
him?
When he's saying Matzah Lu Al Achidaka?
Much later.
No wonder.
They kill him. Do you remember after the war, after the story of Parshat Bilam, they go to war with Bilam. When do they go to war with Bilam? They go to war with Midian.
Right.
It's war with the Midianim.
Right.
And there they kill Bilam.
Right.
And the reference to is no, it's Moshe. No. It's in Parshat Matot Maseh. Parshat Matot Maseh is the actual war. Mm-hmm. But the description of it in is in Yehoshua, and in Yehoshua, Perek Yud Gimel. Again, going back to the history of what happened earlier, much of Sefer Yehoshua is a history review. It says that the conquest, Moshe began a conquest of the east side of the Yarden, including the conquest of the areas of Sichon and Og. You remember that? Pashat Chukat, where they conquered Sichon and Og. Pasuk Chof Aleph. Perek Yud Gimel, Pasuk Chof Aleph. וכל הרי המישור וכל ממלכות סיחון מלך האמורי אשר מלך בחשבון אשר יקם משה אותו ואת נשיאי מדיין right, they smote סיחון and king of חשבון and they smote the נשיאי מדיין who were the נשיאי מדיין אבי, רקם, צור, חור, רבע נשיחי סיחון פסוק הבט ואת בלעם בן באור הקוסם הרגו בני ישראל בחרב So they finally got their revenge against Balaam. And they killed him by the sword.
But when we hear about Balaam beforehand, he's not referred to as Ekosem.
No.
This is only in Yehoshua.
Correct, but one is a remarkably important revelation about the other. Because the question of the status of Balaam is always a major conversation. The Mefarshim have a big machloket as to what. Maybe we'll do this next week. We'll talk a little bit about Balaam. The Mefarshim have a major machloket. What's the status of Balaam? Was he a Navi? Was he not a Navi? Navi Lamota. How do you have Balaam as a Navi? But there is a hint to the fact that Balaam is a Kosem, even in Parshat Balak. Anybody know what it is? When they first invite Balaam to this. Interesting task, right? What was Balaam invited to do?
Curse Israel,
correct? Perek Chof Bet. Bamidbar Perek Chof Bet. Let's take a look at Pasuk Zayin. Pasuk Zayin. Vayelchu zikne Moab v'zikne Midian. The representative delegation from Balak to invite Balaam to curse the Jewish people. Everybody have it? Perek
188.
Vayelchu zikne Midian u'zikne Moab. U'zikne Moab v'zikne Midian. Uksamim biyadam. The delegation, the elders of Midian and Moab, went they came to Balaam to convince him to join this quest to curse Bnei Israel. What did they bring with them?
All sorts of goodies, huh?
Ksamim biyadam.
I thought they bribed him.
Right. It doesn't say that they wanted to bribe him. What did they bring him? They brought him ksamim. So we don't know exactly what these ksamim are. But it's exactly the same context as Bilam ben Bo'o HaKosem. Whatever the tools of the trade are for a Kosem, that's precisely what they brought him. Because that's what he was. All right. How any of this is relevant to our story and the context? We'll come back to it. We're running out of time. I don't want to go over. We will stop here. I'll just pick up this piece at the end, the beginning of next week's shiur. We'll talk a little bit about the significance of the mindset of the Kosem, and then, time permitting, we'll talk about what I had on the agenda for this week.